happen today. John has been hanging with Eli and Mark electronically ever since the raids, but mostly he hangs with Julio, who looks enough like Eli to be his little brother. He has black hair cut to a fade, intelligent brown eyes, an eager teach-me attitude. He wants to know as much as Mark and the others. Julio's a good dude, a little young, but he has a nice swagger, a Bronx tough way of talking when he needs to. He doesn't let anyone push him around. Julio's a little cowed by Mark, though. Most people shrivel under Mark's technical cross-examinations. Julio doesn't shrivel, but sometimes he keeps his distance. There's also a serious core group of hackers who come to the 2600 meetings with hopes of being anointed by MOD. They want to be accepted, but for some reason or another, maybe the MOD boys can smell how bad they want it, and that odor is repellent. The wannabes stay on the fringes. They don't know enough, or they act like they know too much. Whatever. The wannabes offer Mark and Eli tidbits of information. They boast about their own exploits. They tag along to Around the Clock, a diner in Greenwich Village where the hackers go to eat after the meeting breaks up. But they won't get into MOD, ever. Alfredo de la Fe suffers that fate. There's one of him in every single classroom in America. He's the boy who's smart and eager, who wants to be accepted but can't help being a little bit of a know-it-all at just the wrong moment, has to trumpet the fact that he knows the capital of Mozambique. Of course, the teacher likes him and can't figure out why the other kids pick on him. There's the problem right there. Alfredo was cherubic, and that never helped. He was only 15, and that sure didn't help either. He had black ringlets, which probably endeared him to his aunts, but definitely did not broadcast a cool image. He tried to imitate the way the others dressed, in heavy hiking boots and black t-shirts, but just when he thought he'd pulled it off, someone noticed the gold ring on his right pinky. Alfredo used to run his own electronic bulletin board from a second-floor walk-up where he lived, half a block from Central Park. 10 blocks south, and he'd have a Tony address. As it was, even in the mid-90s, he was not far from a really cool two-story McDonald's on Columbus Avenue, a space-age McDonald's with a kind of Star Trek theme. That was one thing in his favor, as far as the MOD boys were concerned. They had a reason to visit him. You had to eat. Alfredo called his board Crime Scene, a pretty boastful name for a whereas board that didn't attract any heavyweight hacker types. Even worse, he was just asking for trouble with his I'm-so-cool handle, Renegade Hacker. The first meeting Alfred had with any of the MOD boys, well before today's 2600 meeting, was when some of them called up to harass him. Alfredo didn't know who the callers were. He says it could have been either John or Julio or Zod on the phone. Could have been all of them, for all he knows. They said, "Give us access to your board or suffer the consequences." Alfredo hung up, but they called back on his other private line immediately. Then they called again on his mom's phone line. He was impressed that they had all his numbers. A week later, Long John Silver phoned Alfredo and filled him in on the whole MOD thing. Who they were, what they did, why he should be friendly. He got the picture, and now Alfredo really wanted to be in MOD. He even set up an exclusive sub-network on his bulletin board so the MOD guys could log in and hang out, like sparrows at a bird feeder. They called a couple of times, but then Alfredo's mom made him take down the board because his grades were slipping. Thanks, Mom. Of everybody in the MOD, Julio was the most cordial to Alfredo. Julio called him on the phone sometimes, and he called him Alf. He even came over to Alfredo's spotless apartment, with the sculpture of the Madonna and Child looming over the dining room table, and the shiny linoleum floor that the Chihuahua was not allowed to walk on. The yappy dog stays in the hall, behind the toddler guard gate. You could hear the dog's toenails clacking back there all day. Sometimes Julio brought John over to Alfredo's, but it was a lot different from the scene in Eli's bedroom. It was no meeting of the minds. For one thing, Julio and John didn't really like Alfredo. At least that's what Alfredo thought from how they acted. One time after they left, Alfredo was missing a modem, worth maybe $50, and a beeper as well. He suspected that John stole the stuff, but John remembers the situation differently. He says Alfredo wanted him to have the modem, also a pocket full of change. It really burned Alfredo, if you must know. You let some guys into your house, and you think they're your friends, but then they pull something like that. Alfredo might be guilty of bad judgment, but he was no geek. He invited Julio and John over again, pretended to forget all about the modem and beeper. He played the lamer supplicant. "Show me some stuff on the computer. Pretty please." Julio and John were only too happy. If they hack into stuff from Alfredo's building, how could the feds ever trace the intrusions back to them? Slick. They would take him on a tour, a hacker's tour of fun sites. Julio would do the typing. They go to New York University, calling a campus computer system that lets them dial out through another modem. From that point on, whatever they do is very hard to trace, and even better, free. To them, at least. They take Alfredo to the internet, big deal, where they show him a whole collection of special interest bulletin boards known as Usenet. They browse one board dedicated to discussing telecommunications. It's just like a hack freak board, except it's for adults. No one uses a handle. The users sign their real names. What fools. Show me something better, says Alfredo. They log on to TRW. Easy, nothing to it. What do you want to look up? Geraldo. Of all the people in the world whose confidential credit histories are online, whose would you like to pull? Geraldo Rivera's. The dude's mean, in your face, and right to the point, just like them. He's Latino, and he's from the city. A credit report spews out. JK2N Rivera, G.0, less than 10,000. 9:10:04:06:502 Rivera. TNJ1, A, P11, People's Westchester Bank, 100-888-00. Could it really be Geraldo's? Cool. The talk show host credit history goes on for pages. American Express, a student loan from Florida, a credit inquiry from World Bank, a Citibank preferred Visa card, a satisfied loan to manufacturer's Hanover Trust, and a mortgage through Citicorp. Of course, they don't know for sure if it is the right Geraldo Rivera, but it's the one who comes up in a classy neighborhood in the metropolitan area. Eventually, they tire of Geraldo and his secrets and move on to the Information America Network. It's an online service that has all sorts of interesting personal data about you and me. That's how Information America makes a living. You have a civil judgment against you, and it goes into the network. The kind of house you live in, the names of the other people who live there, even your neighbors. Information America Network. People Finder. Copyright Information America, Inc. Client billing code 7689. Who do you want to look up? But before anyone else can answer, John decides. Last name, Duke. First name, David. Enter XX equals state abbreviation. MU, multiple states. 3. U.S. nationwide, L.A. Would you like to narrow your search to a specific city? Yes, no, no. Searching. The anticipation is palatable. What would you say to David Duke if you could call him on the blower? What would you say to the redneck Louisiana legislator, a racist who openly admits to being a Ku Klux Klan boss? Within a few seconds, Duke's address, birth date, length of residence appear. Best of all, there's the man's telephone number. John dials. A man answers. He sounds a little old, but what the hell? Yo, says John, slowly, dragging it out to 3 syllables. He sure doesn't sound like a white telephone lineman now. I wanted to talk to you about your daughter. And on and on. It is a wonderful night for Alfredo because, wouldn't you know it, he's been recording the whole session. He records it on his computer, secretly, so that John and Julio don't even know. Every keystroke, every line of text that's printed out on the screen is secretly buffered in a file on Alfredo's computer. After they go home, he prints it out and admires the captured session. It might be useful someday. Alfredo adds it to his collection of confidential documents. He's also managed to procure a printout of the updated history of MOD. That technically may be a confidential MOD file, but hey, it's not so hard to get a hold of, if you know the right people. John and Julio think they're so smart dissing Alfredo, but Alfredo knows a lot of the right people. He's friendly with a lot of guys. Guys who might be just as fed up with the MOD boys posturing and crowing as Alfredo is. Alfredo knows some guys in the LOD, for instance. Well, he sort of knows them, at least well enough to type greetings when they're logged onto the same chat system or something. Alfredo knows Chris Goggins himself, and knows all about the feud between Mark Abeen and Chris. If Alfredo can't get into MOD, he wouldn't mind getting into LOD. As far as Alfredo knows, the LOD boys haven't seen a copy of the history of MOD yet. But they sure would be interested. 10. Downstairs, the front door opens. It is a familiar sound, although Chris Goggins is asleep in the second floor bedroom of his off-campus townhouse in Austin. He wakes to register the click of the latch and to wonder. The door shouldn't be opening at 6 a.m. His roommate isn't even awake yet. There's no time for the wonder to turn to worry. No time at all, it seems, because suddenly, Chris hears a gruff voice shout up the stairwell. Federal agents, search warrant. Chris, bewildered in his boxers, wakes up to see an agent in his room. Chris sits up in his bed and sees all of them, six men wearing badges and carrying guns in holsters, spilling into the house. If you had asked him yesterday, he would have said no way could that small entryway accommodate six grown men at once. From the next room, Goggin's roommate awakens and calls out, Chris, you better wear socks. They make you take off your socks. This visit was no surprise. Both roommates know the agents have come to see Chris. The premonitions weren't exactly psychic. Three hackers in New York were busted in January. Three hackers in Atlanta were busted in February. If that weren't enough to give him a prickly feeling between the shoulder blades, Chris recently learned that his student records had been subpoenaed by a federal prosecutor. In fact, for weeks, the University of Texas student had been semi-expecting just such a near-dawn arrival, expecting the government to come for the computers. But Chris will fight them every inch of the way. Not for nothing he has chosen the hacker handle Eric Bloodaxe. His namesake, a brave Viking warrior with bizarre magical powers, captivated Chris when he read about him in a sixth-grade history book. Eric Bloodaxe is a persona worthy of membership in the Legion of Doom. The original Eric Bloodaxe might have slain these gun-wielding interlopers with a single swipe of his massive steel sword, glinting righteously in the sun. Chris is armed with a more modern weapon, smart-ass college student sarcasm. On Chris's dresser, laid out as plain as anything, to be more obvious, it would need a big red arrow dangling from the ceiling, emblazoned with the words, Look here, is a brochure on how to become a Secret Service agent. The raiders whisk it up, turn it over to their leader. So, you're thinking about joining up, huh?
I think I could help you guys out. Yes, Chris says.
Thus is the bluster of Eric Bloodaxe translated for the late 20th century ear. The federal agents allow Chris to dress. He pulls on a pair of jeans, then goes to sit in the kitchen downstairs. He hears them overhead as they walk around the room where he so recently slept. He hears them pack up his equipment. One of them rustles through papers and finds a copy of a song parody Chris wrote. It's called The End of the Internet. Is this some kind of threat? An agent asks him.
No, just a song, says Chris.
A six-man team is also curious about the arcade-sized Pac-Man machine. They suspect Chris stole it. He says he bought the game from a friend. They phone his friend at 7 a.m. to verify the story. Also snapped up are a bag of stereo cables, wires, and printouts from an electronic magazine called Frack. The agents dig through cereal boxes, flour containers, detergent, apparently looking for drugs. Blue suds foam up. They leave the house carrying boxes. Chris walks them to the car, then watches them drive off into the morning. He wonders if he will be arrested.
When?
He wonders if he will go to jail. For how long? Will it be a big case? Will he be sacrificed on the altar of some prosecutor's career? Pity, Chris. The Viking Eric Bloodaxe would have relieved his anxieties by slaughtering a few goats, at least. But Chris is left at the curb, left to turn and walk back into his townhouse. He closes the door behind him. He hears the familiar muted click. Again, no one got arrested. And maybe because of that, the whole thing took on surreal overtones during the next few days and weeks. Maybe this was some kind of Big Brother bad dream. Maybe it would all go away. Maybe it was just the government's way of harassing a bunch of kids. You know, shut them down by expropriating their computers. That approach didn't work with Chris, who was pugnaciously dialing underground bulletin boards again almost as soon as the federal agents disappeared from his life. There was a new super elite board that he had to check out. It was called Fifth Amendment. The board ran on an IBM computer in a private home in Houston. What was it that would start the buzz? Why did some boards spring from nowhere and overnight build a reputation for being the new hot lure, the BBS with the frankest files, the baddest place to post? Fifth Amendment was suddenly a sensation, no less so than a Prohibition-era speakeasy. Hundreds of hackers knew there was a bright, warm place behind the locked door, but only a dozen or so were privy to the password that would get them beyond the bouncer. What made Fifth Amendment so alluring was the crowd inside. The patrons were a collection of the world's best hackers, or so the huddled masses outside whispered to one another. Word got around. Fifth Amendment boasted an international clientele. Dutch hackers, the Dutch, were said to be on the board. So were the guys from the Chaos Computer Club. A man named Empty Promise, an ex-Navy cryptography expert, logs in from time to time to discuss the intricacies of the phone company's packet switching networks. Some of LOD's rock-solid original members were on the board. Here, on a personal computer, on a desktop in a bedroom in Houston, the Hacker Underground's elite consorted with one another. The board's operators, a hacker named Micron, who owned the actual IBM hardware, and his friend Scott Chasen, alias Doc Holliday, kept the list of users very small, very private. In this climate of uncertain civil liberties and Operation Sun Devil, where the government cracked down on first one hacker and then another without warning or obvious patterns, a lot of the best hackers had put their modems on the back shelf in their closets. Micron and Scott wanted to bring them back from the dead by providing a safe haven for the free interchange of ideas, and whatever. By being so exclusive, Fifth Amendment would protect its users from incriminating themselves. Hence the name. Chris logged in, using an authorized username that came directly from the system operators. The password was changed often, disseminated directly from the system operators to each authorized user. Chris would read the files, chat with the other users, correspond for a while with Scott Chasen. Chris and Scott had an electronic friendship that dated back to the mid-1980s, back to the days when they accidentally bumped into each other in the great plains of cyberspace. They both were logged into a Midwestern-based underground bulletin board called World of Crichton. Crichton was run by a Milwaukee hacker who boasted membership in the elite gang that called itself the 414s, named after Milwaukee's area code. The gang's fame derived from the fact that members had figured out back in 1983 how to hack into the computer system of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in Manhattan. The 414s had messed around with some files for a while, but the main effect of their actions had been to get arrested. Back in the days of Crichton, or maybe soon after, Scott and Chris discovered they had a lot in common. They were close in age, babies conceived on the cusp of the 1970s, both born and raised in the secure style afforded the white middle class in Texas. Both Scott and Chris grew up in a place where their status in society was assured by who they were and where they came from. Maybe at some level, that was the comfortable quality they recognized in each other when they first started corresponding on Crichton. Or maybe the foundation of their friendship was built on similar childhood journeys of electronic discovery. Both had been intoxicated while still in grade school by the blink and whir of a desktop machine. Both endured their parents' divorces. Each had been the third party in computer love triangles by age 10, falling for machinery already claimed by another. There was something illicit about it, which made each keystroke mean more somehow. With Chris hunkered down in front of an old Apple that belonged to a friend's father, and Scott gingerly stealing processing time off a PC that had been a gift to his older sister. Whatever the source of their affinity, by the time they cavorted on Fifth Amendment, Chris and Scott were unquestionably allies. The two friends spoke on the phone a lot, too. They did conference bridges. Bridges were the best. Chris and Scott were part of the mad rush of excited hackers who all glommed on the same open phone line, crowding into a conversation like it was a rush hour subway. The phone line in question belonged to, well, let's just say it was temporarily liberated from the phone company, allowing anarchic hackers to engage in huge transcontinental conference calls that bridge across this city and through that state as one kid after another gets on the line. If you were on the line and you had three-way calling on your phone, you could invite a friend to join the conference call too. Simply hit the flash button that disconnects a call, then call your friend, then flash again. Your friend is three-wayed in now. And if he has three-way calling, he can recruit yet another caller to the conference. These daisy chains lasted for hours, for days, for marathon amounts of time that adults couldn't even imagine. There was so much to say. Bridges were a great way to get acquainted. You could take a tour of the world on a bridge. Talk to one hacker in Holland at the same time you converse with somebody in New York City. In fact, a couple of mysterious New York newcomers named Corrupt and Outlaw brushed up against Texas kids pretty often during conferences. Chris and Scott had never actually met the New York boys, but they'd heard of them, vaguely. They'd heard that Corrupt and Outlaw came from the inner city ghetto, but they seemed to know their stuff. One night, on a bridge, about five or six hackers, all kids from Texas, you understand, were hanging out on the line. What were they talking about? Random stuff. Chris says he wasn't on. Scott is on. Suddenly another voice calls into the conference, joins the group in mid-sentence. This unknown newcomer does not have an accent common to these parts. Yo, this is Dope Fiend from MOD. The newcomer says, in distinctly non-white, non-middle-class, non-Texan inflection. One of the Texans, who knows who, takes umbrage. Get that nigger off the line. The newcomer is silent. In fact, the whole conference bridge is suddenly silent. All the chattering boys brought up hard and cold against the implacable feel of such a word. You might as well have slapped their faces. Interminable seconds pass. Who wants to fill that void? Then the newcomer speaks with a different accent, and the words he says to the white boys from Texas are these. Hi, this is Corrupt.
And that's how it happened. It was as simple as uttering one ugly word. The racial epithet instantaneously moved northward over hundreds of miles of cable, ringing in the ear of John Lee, who sits at his Commie 64 in his Brooklyn bedroom way at the other end of the line. That word hit John like a billy club. Here he was, calling up probably some of the same guys he's chatted with who knows how many times, and the class clown decided to tease them a little. He's got a million voices, you know that, from middle-aged phone lineman to street corner pimp. He never figured that his joke would elicit such a response. Get that nigger off the line? Who yelled it? It's really immaterial at this point because John was going to make them cry. Nothing would ever be the same again. Not for Chris and Scott, not for the boys from MOD, not for the loose-knit community that made up the Hacker Underground. With that one word, war had been declared. You don't survive on the street by allowing white boys to call you nigger. Of course, John didn't say any of this to them. Not then. In fact, they all chatted amiably for a while, long enough for Scott to decide that John really knew his stuff. A few days later, after learning more about John and Julio, and M.O.D., Scott offered John an account on Fifth Amendment. You've got a good reputation as somebody who knows a lot about vaxes, Scott said to John. We could use somebody like you down here in Houston. Thanks a lot, John said. Just one thing, Scott warned. We'll give you an account, but don't give it to your buddy Mark up there, or your buddy Acid Freak. In the wake of the Harper's Forum and the Secret Service raids, Mark and Eli had become notorious, and Eli in particular was gaining a reputation for being a media hound. Sure, said John. Right. Whatever you say, dude. A few days went by, and John logged into Fifth Amendment calling himself Corrupt. He read the files, he typed messages, he abided by Scott's injunction that he shouldn't try to copy anything that was on the board. Then one day, two new users showed up on the board. They called themselves Broken Leg and Flaming Carrot. They were really obnoxious whenever they logged in. Nobody knew who these guys were. John said he didn't know either. John ventured back into the conference bridges, bringing along his friend Julio. The Texas boys were quite civilized to them. Real friendly, in fact, John thought. One night, John and Julio called into a bridge, and a bunch of people were on the line. John couldn't tell who was talking and who was listening, but you could hear the way the Texans referred to him and Julio, the niggers and spicks from New York. John and Julio stayed quiet on the line. They didn't give themselves away. This time, John wasn't as shocked, but Julio was mad, madder than John had ever seen him. They don't know who specifically had been slurring them. They don't recognize a voice, but they know from the accent that it's a southerner. They want to get back at somebody. And the only southerners they know who call people nigger are the Texans who hang out on Fifth Amendment. Come on, let's do something to these guys, Julio says. And John agrees that it's time to make their move. Abandoning their handles of Corrupt and Outlaw, they don their alter ego personas, Broken Leg and Flaming Carrot. For it was they who had needled the LOD members and crept stealthily back into the Texans' seat of power. They storm Fifth Amendment. There happened to be a particularly juicy file posted on Fifth Amendment. It was a technical treatise on how to crack a ROM-made PBX phone system. ROM PBXs, as any hacker in 1990 could have told you, are valuable properties. They are favored by large corporations and government agencies, which need to route thousands of calls a day to their employees. The file on Fifth Amendment said that this particular type of PBX had a backdoor entrance to enable repairs by remote maintenance support staff. The file went on to explain how to break into the system using the back door, and how, once inside, to monitor phone lines. Armed with such knowledge, virtually anyone anywhere could crack a ROM PBX. The patrons of the Fifth Amendment board didn't want such information widely disseminated for one simple reason. If lamers got hold of it, they'd go into a PBX and screw something up. ROM would get complaints from customers, and the whole system would be overhauled to close up the holes. So while the file was available for perusal, you weren't supposed to copy it. Don't share it with anybody who didn't have access to Fifth Amendment. What better way to tweak the Texans than to spread their precious secrets? John, acting as Broken Leg, snatched the file, surreptitiously copying it right off its super-secure resting place on the BBS. It was a fine deception. Less than a week later, the ROM revelation was posted on bulletin boards all over the country. The Texans were incensed. Such highly specific technical information could only have come from one source.
a leak from one of Fifth Amendment's users. Who among the chosen could have been so disloyal? Scott started to monitor all the users, and within days, he noticed a pattern. Whenever John logged in, he copied files, then logged back out. Scott and Chris immediately suspected that John was operating on the instructions of someone else, a mastermind who lurked in the background and directed John to do his bidding. John and Chris had the same thought, Mark Abeen. This suspicion they could not abide. Scott confronted John, electronic style. The next time John logged into Fifth Amendment using the corrupt handle, he saw this message flash across his screen. Apparently, Corrupt has been distributing information posted on this board to his little buddies. We have evidence. The battle lines were drawn now. No matter that Mark Abeen had nothing to do with the Fifth Amendment escapade. Scott and Chris didn't care any more about the specifics than John did the day he heard someone calling him nigger over a conference bridge. It was New York City against Texas. Chris decided it was time to improve the image of LOD. In the aftermath of the raids, a lot of its core hackers had just plain disappeared. Maybe they'd gotten jobs, maybe they'd gone to college, or maybe they just got scared. In any case, Chris wanted to attract new talent and use that talent toward positive knowledge. It was all part of his plan to change his life. The raid at his house had really spooked him, and his grades were going to hell this semester because he was so bummed. So it was only natural that Eric Bledax decided to take action. There was no future in the underground. Any fool could see it was a bunch of kids living dangerously. And Chris was getting a little old for the break into the phone system and control the world fantasy. He only saw one choice for him. He had to change the way he viewed computers, because he couldn't give up computers. He spent 12 hours a day at the keyboard. What was he going to do without it? He had no other hobbies, wasn't interested in much else, didn't even believe in politics or the Electoral College. His plan was simply to stop fighting the establishment, to join it instead and beat on your enemies at the same time. Ever since he'd read a book by Don Parker, Fighting Computer Crime, he'd been nursing the idea. You could get paid for this stuff, Chris thought. It was a great book. He'd bought it in hardcover. In his plan, Chris saw himself evolving. No longer was he a threat to corporate computer security. No longer was the LOD a dark gang of anarchic kids trying to subvert phone company security efforts. No, in Chris's plan, he and LOD emerged from this bad period to become the new force for good, the hackers in the white hats who would police cyberspace for the rest of us. He liked that vision. Chris could see himself tracking down errant hackers, like the bad boys of MOD. He could see himself making the judgment about whether specific hacking activities are worthy or dangerous. He could even see himself turning people in. Yeah, he definitely could see that. Because the whole scene was getting out of control. There was a career in this. Chris began to tell people he'd like to get into computer security. He'd be a hired gun. The idea appealed immediately to Scott Chasen, who'd wanted to be a computer consultant since the age of 12. It probably would have appealed to just about any teenage hacker in America, because in each dirty, sock-strewn bedroom sits a boy who nurses a dream of being discovered and offered a job doing computer security. The dream goes like this. Enter a company name here. Will be so impressed with my abilities to crack its system that the CEO will call me up and offer to put me on the payroll. I'll show them how to plug the holes to keep other people just like me from penetrating the system. A lot of boys were waiting for the phone to ring, or would be if they were off the phone. Eric Bledax didn't wait. He put phase one of his plan into action immediately. Reform LOD's image with new blood so the gang could earn the kind of squeaky clean reputation that the Boy Scouts used to enjoy. The transformation of LOD was cause for talk. Every hacker on every bulletin board seemed to know about it. And of course, Mark Abeen got word too. He couldn't get back into the LOD controlled by Chris, that was for sure. But at this point, he didn't even want to. He had new friends, for one thing. In the aftermath of the raid on his house, Mark was a little skittish. That didn't stop him from hacking. Mark got a laptop computer in a trade and started hacking from phone booths, even allowing a couple of writers from Esquire to tag along for the sessions. But Mark was more than a little wary about being identified with an organized hacking group. To him, MOD had always been a joke. To try and resurrect the carcass of an actual, well-known gang like LOD, well, that seemed like waving something in the face of the government. You were asking for trouble. But Mark would not be Mark if he kept his opinions to himself. Mark counseled other hackers not to join LOD. It's boneheaded. You'll get into trouble. LOD doesn't know squat. They have nothing but moronic, out-of-date files. When Chris discovered the propaganda program, he was enraged because he saw Mark's comments as part of a bigger pattern of harassment. You see, someone had been messing around with Chris on the phone. Chris suspected MOD. Who else could it be? Well, in fact, it was the work of John Lee. John never runs from a fight. One thing he likes is to see his enemy cry. He's not sure why, but he really enjoys that. Chris is John's enemy, will be forever. But at this point, he doesn't even know him by the name Chris. He just knows Eric Bledaxe. John had decided to make his enemy's life miserable. First, John had to learn Eric Bledaxe's real name. You couldn't exactly call directory assistance in Austin and ask for a listing for a resident named Bledaxe. That's Axe with an E. But Chris was so notorious in the underground that it didn't take John long to get the information he needed. John bypassed directory assistance altogether. He instead called a Southwestern Bell computer, from there logged into a switch, and simply looked up Chris's phone number from the 3-bedroom suburban-type house he was renting in North Austin. Then the calls started. Sometimes John used his ghetto accent to harass Chris. Other times John and a friend call Chris and whisper into the receiver, "Mr. Elite, Mr. Elite," in a very mocking tone. Chris suspects that it's John and Julio, but he can't prove it, and the calls drive him crazy. Part of the problem is that Chris can't make out the words for sure, and sometimes the ominous whispers sound like they're saying, "Mystery Elite? Mystery Elite?" which makes no sense to Chris. The phone calls are constant. It doesn't help to hang up. The receiver is barely down before the phone rings again, and again, and again. You have to take it off the hook and leave it off the hook for hours. Sometimes when they prank Chris, the callers say, "Here, talk to your friend." And then before Chris can hang up, he hears a click, and then Scott is on the line too, three-wayed into a call against his will, and he's saying, "Hello? Hello? Who is this?" In Chris's mind, this type of harassment definitely fell into the category of behavior that is unacceptable. If he were already working in computer security, he could put a stop to it. He and Scott talked about the situation a lot. They even came up with a name for the company they wanted to create. ComSec Data Security was the full stuffy name, but neither of them thought of it in that formal way. No, for Chris and Scott, the venture would always simply be ComSec. In December, a couple of momentous things happened. First, Scott and Chris met face-to-face for the first time. Whether they looked like what the other expected, neither ever says. Chris is lanky and long-haired, looks like a hippie, and Scott is shorter and wiry, hair cut close like an army cadet. The two met at HoHoCon, an annual hackers conference that kids travel from all over the country to attend. They're the new iteration of Shriners, and every year they converge in Texas for the purpose of holing up in the cheapest hotel in Houston that will take them, right before Christmas, thus Ho-Ho. They stay up all night, hacking and talking acronym to one another. They sleep all day and wake toward dusk to forage for tasty cakes, colas, and similar sustenance. HoHoCon is invitation only, but it still gets a little rowdy. And midway through the so-called conference this year, the group got evicted from La Quinta Travel Lodge and checked into Howard Johnson's, thus Ho-Ho Hojo. Chris and Scott were telling everybody they met about ComSec, about their vision for its future, and right away they hooked up with another hacker named Kenyon Shulman. He lives in Houston, and he's a lot richer than the other hackers. In fact, his mom is a genuine socialite, and before his arrival at the conference, the rumor was that Kenyon drives a black BMW. When he pulled up, he was in a Mercedes. Just a Mercedes. Kenyon was pretty excited about the whole ComSec scheme. In fact, he had the deep pockets that might actually transform the idea into reality. Kenyon has an old friend in Atlanta who is about to graduate from Emory University. Kenyon's friend was headed for a job trading securities, and the two had been toying with the idea of a little startup venture. Kenyon got on the phone at Hojo's, called down to Atlanta, and before anybody knew it, ComSec was a reality. The four of them, Chris, Scott, Kenyon, and Rob in Atlanta, figured they'd need about $100,000 for startup costs. But that was no problem, because Kenyon was willing to put down $80,000 as a basis to get a loan. They figured they'd need an office to set up business, but that was no problem, because Kenyon's mom would give them free footage in some real estate she owns, a one-story office building behind a strip mall in Houston. Can you imagine how exciting this all sounded to a bunch of students? It was really great to have so many options in life, to know the right people, to have access to money when you needed it. It was the end of the 1980s, and the news hadn't sunk in yet that the decade's great leverage and expansion possibilities were threatened. No, it was still the land of opportunity out there, and all it took to capitalize on it was a few bright ideas hatched in a Howard Johnson's. Oh, yeah, and a lot of cash. But that was no problem if you made your new friend Kenyon an equal partner. After HoHoCon ended, Chris had to go back to Austin to finish up the spring semester. But Scott wasn't a student. He was working in Houston in what he called a poor slob job. He entered data all day into the computers of the Academy Corporation, which owns a chain of sporting goods stores throughout the state. Scott and Kenyon were working all night, every night, to lay the foundation for ComSec before Rob and Chris moved to town in the spring. Scott went to the library to look up all the computer security firms in the United States and counted them. Not too many. He researched what each company specialized in, analyzing the industry to see how best to position ComSec. Research, research, every night. He even researched how to buy office supplies, where to get the best deal. Of course, there is one major distraction, the MOD-LOD war, which reaches the crescendo in the winter of 1990. One day, Chris gets hold of a copy of the History of MOD. The spurned Alfredo gives it to him, proving again there is a high price to pay for adolescent cruelty. Chris feels he has been teased and provoked enough. The MOD boys have logged into the Southwestern Bell switch that controls his phone service and switched his long-distance carrier from Sprint to AT&T. Chris didn't know how that happened until he tried to dial long-distance. He doesn't hear the familiar click. So then, of course, he had to call up the phone company. Try explaining the situation to a clerk in the business office, and you'll know why he's so annoyed. Chris figures that John was the one who switched his long-distance carrier on him. He also believes, incorrectly, that John is the author of The History of MOD. So Chris gets hold of the Boswellian tale and decides to pull a little mischief. Chris has an old computer program that will translate any file into a new language. In this case, when he feeds The History of MOD to the program, out pops a jived version of the document. The program simply searches for certain words or word forms and replaces them with others. In goes the original language that Eli wrote. In the early part of 1987, there were numerous amounts of busts in the U.S., and in New York in particular. Out comes, in the early part of 1987, there was numerous amounts of busts in the U.S., and in New York in particular. In goes Eli's description of his own activities in 1989. It came about when Acid Freak, then using another handle, had been running a semi-private BBS off his Commodore piece of shit and 10 generic commie drives. Out comes the jived version. It came about when Acid Freak, then using another handle, had been running a semi-private fucking BBS off his commo piece of shit and 10 generic commie drives. The jive program also adds racially offensive phrases to the text. Every couple of lines, for instance, the phrase slap my fro or she it appears in the text as a kind of hateful refrain. Him's handle was DeWin, and he ran some Unix system from his crib in Pennsylvania. Shit. Scobin was always some Unix guru, while Acid had only just across it in college 2 years back. Using the Jive program is the equivalent of appearing in blackface. Chris does his work in the gracious surroundings of Kenyon's townhouse. An English tapestry depicts a hunt scene on one wall of the office. Bookshelves line another. On the shelves looking down at Chris's work are the unjived versions of books by Hume, Freud, Plato. It takes Chris a couple of hours to get the jive program to work right, to convince it to insert spaces in the right spots between words, and to add punctuation where called for. He works intently, enveloped by a red leather chair that's roomy enough to sleep in. Some nigga named Corrupt haven't been real active before. Doesn't got some soaking computer anymore. And so, shit, duh. Chris doesn't consider himself a racist. He has black friends at work, he says. If you ask him why he jived the History of MOD, he says it just seemed funny. Hilarious, he says. If you're out to get someone, you're going to do anything you can to make him mad, Chris says. Anything. He didn't have a translation program to turn the MOD boys' prose into, say, a Lithuanian accent or something. He only had a jive program. So what was he supposed to do? If you lived in Texas, you'd understand, Chris says. Down here, we all have boots and hats. We all ride on the range. Long before the jive version gets officially published in the April 1991 issue of Frack, John sees a copy of Chris's handiwork. Of course, John isn't sitting in a red leather chair in a room adorned by tapestries when he sees it. He's sitting in front of a computer that looks like it was cobbled together from junkyard parts. He has a big old TV console for a monitor, a messed up keyboard, and his old Commie 64, bandaged with electrical tape. His computer is a street box, a gorilla machine. It's about 7 in the evening, dark enough already to warn you away from the ideas that spring might come early to New York City. And John's sitting in the same chair he always uses in his bedroom. From time to time, he hears sirens scream down faraway streets. He can also hear, through the open windows, the rapacious demands of rap music. The lyrics and the insistent beat drift up the sidewalk, as one boombox after another passes under the window of his row house. Inside, the only thing on John's walls are a couple of posters advertising 9X Yellow Pages. Their messages are funny, and that's why John has them on the wall. One shows Barbie and Ken looking under the entry for plastic surgeons. Another shows the entry, chicken ready to serve, under a picture of a hen with a tennis racket. John has a third handle, Net Ones. Corrupt and broken leg somehow just didn't say it all for him. He sees that a file has been sent to his Net Ones account. And there it is on the screen, the jived history of MOD. De legacy of de underground clandestine network continues, and so does de war and ridiculing against all the self-proclaimed so-called elite. John can't believe it at first. It's too outlandish. He reads through it slowly, amazed. Slap my fro? John finishes reading, then sits for a minute, staring at the screen, staring away from the screen, just kind of staring, and he thinks, this guy really doesn't like me. This is aimed right at me, and only me. 11. One day, Tom Kaiser's phone rings, and on the other end of the line is an official from TimeNet. TimeNet, you will recall, is the sprawling privately owned data network that computers use to send information to one another around the world. You dial a local phone number. It's called a dial-up because you're literally dialing up the TimeNet computer. Once you're in, you can connect to any computer worldwide that's hooked up to the system. Today, the TimeNet official tells Kaiser that TimeNet has a problem. The huge network has somehow been penetrated by an unknown hacker. The hacker is roaming through computers that belong to a rather influential customer. The customer's computers are all hooked up to one another, forming what is known as a subnetwork within the TimeNet structure. The official says that TimeNet has only been able to trace back to the general area where the calls are originating, New York City. Oh, and one other thing. The TimeNet official would rather not identify the customer. It's a sensitive situation, you understand. Kaiser understands sensitive situations. The lawman says he thinks he can help. The trick here will be to figure out where the intruder lives. TimeNet traced the call as far back as the New York City dial-up that the hacker used to enter the TimeNet system. Of course, TimeNet has hundreds of dial-ups in major cities worldwide, and more than one in New York City. So even if the hacker phoned a specific New York City dial-up one day, he could easily call another one the next time. There's no way that Kaiser can instruct dozens of phone switches around the country to monitor or trap all the calls coming in to every single one of TimeNet's phone numbers. Kaiser, however, can do a live trace while the hacker is on the phone. That's dicier, because if the hacker hangs up before the trace is completed, the intruder is gone. There's no way to say where he called from. Kaiser has no clue about the culprit's identity. The last people he suspects are members of the MOD squad. After all, a year after the raids, cases are still pending against Mark, Eli, and Paul. It's winter again in New York City, a slushy, yucky affair that's been slopping over the tops of Kaiser's shoes every morning as he tromps up the steps from the subway into his office building. It's been a little frustrating for the lawman, waiting for the federal government to resolve the hacker cases. In fact, the assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District who handles cases has been running into some roadblocks. It seems that his bosses don't think that prosecuting a handful of teenagers is a good thing to do with the resources of the office. It seems that the bosses don't really grasp the significance of the case. What's a switch, they ask. The boys' cases have been bounced out of federal court, in fact, and handed off to the Queens District Attorney. There's been a little delay as the office got up to speed. Kaiser even made a few trips out to Queens to explain the technical aspects of the case. Finally, charges were filed against Mark in state court, charging him with a misdemeanor. So Kaiser certainly hasn't forgotten about the MOD investigation, far from it. One worry he harbors is that the hackers might harm the New York telephone system in retaliation for the MOD prosecution. There's been nothing Kaiser can do to relieve his worry, though. He has no proof, no evidence, no tips. Nor does he have any reassurances that the hackers won't retaliate. While the phone company has the legal right to monitor its own lines, Kaiser can't abuse the privilege by randomly spying on people. Before he asks his bosses for permission to put up a DNR, he has to have convincing evidence that such a step is necessary. He can't say he wants to monitor a customer's phone line simply because he worries. He needs some concrete reason to do it. On the phone with TimeNet, Kaiser goes over the procedure for a live trace. As soon as the intruder is spotted in your network, call me. I'll start to track him immediately. It's essential to move fast. If the connection is broken before we complete the trace, we'll never know who the intruder is. Got it. By the time Kaiser learned who TimeNet's secret customer was, winter had given way to spring. It is May now. It's warm. It's sunny. You can even hear birds tweeting in Manhattan, for God's sake. Kaiser had been expecting to hear from TimeNet again, but this time the phone call comes directly from the TimeNet customer, a client who well knows that minutes are precious during a trace. The customer is Southwestern Bell. Southwestern Bell is a sibling of New York Telephone, another of the regional phone companies born of the AT&T divestiture. But Southwestern Bell can't execute a trace over New York Telephone's lines, having no access to phone lines in the Northeast. Southwestern Bell's kingdom stretches across Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas, where a web of computers connect about 12 million customers. Those computers perform the company's switching operations, route calls, bill customers, and process administrative work. Since its computer system spans so much of the country, Southwestern Bell decided to set up a subnetwork on TimeNet. That way, any Southwestern Bell employee could call into the system for the price of a local call, using a TimeNet dial-up. The TimeNet pipeline is a great convenience to Southwestern Bell's employees. It was also a great convenience to hackers. That pipeline enabled a hacker sitting anywhere in the United States to call a local TimeNet phone number, get into TimeNet's system, and then burrow right into Southwestern Bell's computers. Southwestern Bell became aware of the problem one morning when the administrator for one of the company's central depots, the C-Scan system, came into work. The administrator noticed from a log that it appeared he himself had been signed on and using the computer during the previous night. He had not. Now, C-Scans is a sensitive and complex system. The client system's computer access network standards is a central operation that distributes information and administers patches throughout Southwestern Bell's region. When the Bell company wants to upgrade software across its network, the new program is funneled through C-Scans into each switch. From C-Scans, you can hop right into any of those switches and start looking around. C-Scans also stores internal electronic mail sent among Southwestern Bell workers. Security memos are stored there, too. As soon as the system administrator realized that some unauthorized user had penetrated the system, he had to bring down the computer to try and find out how the intrusions occurred. Bringing down the computer cost Southwestern Bell money, both for paying employees to fix the problem and in lost computer processing time. But the hacker didn't seem to be limited to any one spot in the system. Perhaps because he'd learned so much about the other switches he'd explored through C-Scans, he was popping up all over Southwestern Bell's computers. The people at Southwestern Bell sure would appreciate Kaiser's help. And today, on May 31st, 1991, at this very moment of 4:31 in the afternoon, a hacker is logging into Southwestern Bell's mighty NetCon VAC system in St. Louis, which controls switching networks in four states. The hacker has a valid user ID, Carol W. The Carol W. account belongs to a communications technician with access to sensitive documents about the network security within the NetCon VAC system. The technician doesn't know who could have gotten a hold of her ID. It's urgent. He's on the line right now, the Southwestern official tells Kaiser. Southwestern Bell reports that the call came in through TimeNet, so Kaiser keeps Southwestern Bell on the line, then immediately calls TimeNet officials on another. Let's say the hacker got into TimeNet using the dial-up at 555-4700. That's a number in Lower Manhattan, Kaiser says, recognizing the prefix. The drill is to trace the call backward from its dial-up to its origin. Minutes are ticking by as Kaiser puts TimeNet on hold and tries the New York Telephone Switching Control Center located downtown on West Street. This is Tom Kaiser in security. Where is the call coming from? Down in the West Street office, nobody hesitates. The technicians know that when security calls, it's not for a run-of-the-mill request. No, West Street might put Kaiser on hold for a fraction of a second and simultaneously call him back on another line to verify he's really who he says he is. But by the time Kaiser answers that call, he has a lot of phone lines in his office. West Street will have the answer he needs. The call's coming in on an AT&T trunk line, says West Street. If you make a long-distance call using AT&T, your call travels to its destination along a line that's designated to carry AT&T customers' calls. That's a trunk line. AT&T? Kaiser repeats, and he's already dialing again. This is bad, since it means the hacker may not be calling from New York City after all. He could be anywhere, just using the New York City dial-up. Meanwhile, back at Southwestern Bell, security personnel audit the intruder's every move as it occurs, hoping the hacker won't get bored and hang up. It's maddening, not to mention terrifying, since the phones in four states are controlled by this VAX computer. They watch in shock as the hacker, disguised as Carol W., coolly calls up some internal security alerts sent by Bellcor. Bellcor, or Bell Communications Research, is the research and development arm of the seven regional Bell companies. Back in the 1980s, when AT&T's monolithic empire was broken up, divided into a long-distance company that AT&T could still control and seven autonomous regional siblings, one thing AT&T was allowed to keep was the prestigious Bell Labs. The telecommunications laboratory has an illustrious history. Research at Bell Labs developed everything from the laser to talking motion pictures. The baby Bells got together and funded their own think tank, their own Disneyland of future ideas, Bellcor. Much of what Bellcor does is to develop new standards for improving the phone networks. Bellcor researchers do a lot of on-the-edge blue sky stuff, trying to figure out the future direction of the communications revolution. One of Bellcor's most important functions is security. Bellcor periodically sends memos to all the regional telephone companies to announce a breach of security at one or another of the local phone companies. The memos describe intrusions, and in some cases, the intruders themselves. To a hacker, this is extremely valuable information because the memos also explain security techniques that exist to fix the loopholes. The hackers stay a step ahead. This particular hacker is browsing in those memos now, reading files about other hackers. He's hacking Southwestern Bell's anti-hacker archives. It's almost 5 o'clock in New York, and nobody knows how much longer the call will last. Kaiser has AT&T security on the phone now, and the long-distance carrier's technician quickly traces the call on Trunkline to a toll-free 800 number in Pennsylvania. This can mean only one thing. The hacker is purposely hiding his tracks. Here's how. The hacker has called a toll-free number assigned to some unsuspecting corporation in Pennsylvania, the same toll-free number the corporation's employees use to check in. The computer has a PBX, a private branch exchange to manage internal phone calls. Only like most of the novices in telecommunications, the company doesn't know how to secure the system. Who would suspect that someone would want to breach it? Ah, but lots of hackers have found these vulnerabilities and were using them like free long-distance calling cards. This hacker merely pressed 9 to get a dial tone that would allow him to call back out, right from the corporation's phone system to TimeNet. It's simple, and it's smart, because it's certainly slowing down Kaiser. Kaiser checks his watch as he dials the officials at the Bell Atlantic switch that controls the 800 number. "Where's the call coming from into that 800 line?" he asks. "The call is coming from New York." New York, back in Kaiser's jurisdiction again. Even as Kaiser works the phones faster than Lily Tomlin did on Laugh-In, officials at Southwestern Bell are getting antsy, sending a collective mental plea to the hacker, "Please don't hang up. Not yet." "Where in New York?" Kaiser thinks he's yelling into the phone. But really, his tone is quite calm. He's only shrieking inside. "Brooklyn." Kaiser calls the New York telephone switch in Brooklyn. Now Southwestern Bell officials are talking in his other ear, saying the intruder has finished reading the memos. He's copying the files onto his own computer to read later and divide like stolen money. Is the hacker getting ready to hang up? Into the other line, Kaiser barks at a technician at the Brooklyn switch. "Kaiser, from security, where is this call originating? I need to know now." The New York telephone technician says, "The call is coming from 555-1318. Success. It's 509. The trace took 38 minutes. Much longer than a trace normally takes, but then a typical trace request is one that comes from the cops, who say there's a potential suicide on the line. Where's he calling from? That's an easy enough matter. Just call the switch, ask one question, write down the number, 5 minutes, you're finished. Kaiser's done it plenty. Today's activities, however, are of another magnitude. Within a mere 38 minutes, Kaiser has traced a call back from Southwestern Bell through TimeNet, through a New York telephone switch to an AT&T line, to a toll-free number in Pennsylvania, to a switch in Pennsylvania, then back to another switch in New York City, and finally to a building in Brooklyn. The hacker threaded his call in an attempt to escape detection through at least 6 separate computers, and Kaiser smoothed out the tangles. That is a day's work. Kaiser writes down the number, and then he looks it up on his computer. Let's see. 555-1318 is assigned to a subscriber at 64A Kosciusko Street in Brooklyn. Weird. It even sounds familiar. The hacker lives in the neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant. Kaiser gets back to the phone to Southwestern Bell's anxious officials and gives them the news. He hears a cheer go up on their end of the line. Kaiser remembered where he'd seen that address and phone number before. John's number was one that Mark had called frequently back in 1989 and early 1990. The DNR kept track. Kaiser had seen John's name before, too, scrawled alongside the doodles in the notebook confiscated from Mark's house during the raids. That's how Kaiser knew John Lee's handle was corrupt. That's how Kaiser knew John Lee was in MOD. In the days that followed, Kaiser would perform more traces for Southwestern Bell and TimeNet. Sometimes the connection got broken before he could navigate the labyrinth of phone lines. But Kaiser was successful in tracing another call, this time to Julio's address in the Bronx. Julio's phone number was in Mark's notebook, too. So was Julio's handle, Outlaw. Julio must be in MOD, too. So Southwestern Bell knew that it had to deal with at least two intruders, and now Kaiser knew that he was back on MOD's trail. The Secret Service was moving on the case, big time. But the Secret Service is also starting a new investigation, treating the Southwestern Bell intrusions, which clearly posed a threat to a significant portion of the nation's phone lines, as a case of their own. The Secret Service didn't put it together with the old MOD case from 1990. As a new case, the Southwestern Bell problem has a new prosecutor. It's the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District, which has geographic jurisdiction over Manhattan and the Bronx. This was the first computer case assigned to Stephen Fishbein in the 3 years he'd been working as an assistant U.S. attorney. But he is far from technophobic. In fact, Fishbein has an identical twin who's a chip designer in Boston, and Fishbein is not afraid of computers. That put him a step ahead of some of the other lawyers who would find themselves involved in what would become known as the Masters of Deception conspiracy case. But even after Fishbein started delving into the computer intrusions that John and Julio committed from their homes, it would be months before the full scope of their involvement with the earlier case against Mark, Paul, and Eli became clear. After the successful traces, the authorities tell the switch that controls certain phone lines to Southwestern Bell's computers to trap incoming calls. Whenever someone calls the phone numbers, a computer writes down the origin of the call. Every time John or Julio calls, a computer records the time and date. The monitoring is quite definitive. DNRs go up again, this time on the phones at John and Julio's houses. Here's what they show. On June 2nd, at 2 minutes before midnight, Julio calls TimeNet for 19 minutes. As soon as he hangs up, he calls Mark. The next day, around supper time, Julio makes a 1 minute call to TimeNet, then a 15-minute call to another TimeNet dial-up. Then he calls Mark. On July 1st, in the early afternoon, Julio calls Mark twice. 2 minutes later, Julio calls TimeNet for 19 minutes. Then he calls Mark. On July 4th at 4 in the afternoon, John makes 9 calls in a row to TimeNet. Then he calls Mark. Over and over again, the pattern repeats, just like it did when the earlier DNRs were up in 1989. Calls to TimeNet, calls to Mark, calls to TimeNet, calls to Mark. You'd think Mark would know better than to engage in illegal hacking by now. After he was charged with a misdemeanor in state court in Queens, he pleaded guilty to call forwarding phones to a 900 number. Mark's plea did not specify the nature of the 900 number, but police told reporters that he was calling sex lines. Mark hotly denied it. What would he be doing calling sex lines? But there was nothing he could do to quell the rumors. Mark's sentence was 35 hours of community service at a hospital in Queens. The outcome of that case reinforced Mark's perception that hacking was not an offense the government took seriously. Despite being convicted, nothing really bad had happened to him. Somewhere between early 1990 and now, the case had fizzled. Not only had the U.S. Attorney's Eastern District Office wrangled out of prosecuting the kids, but the Electronic Frontier Foundation had never followed up on its initial interest in the case, a sign the hackers interpreted as meaning they weren't in real danger from the government. The MOD boys didn't know that Kapor and Barlow backed off because Kapor's lawyer had told them he didn't see a real civil liberties case to pursue. The boys' 1989 and 1990 transgressions appeared to them to be petty trespasses. So it was no wonder that Mark rationalized his decision to continue hacking. That was his identity. Fiber optic. Nowhere else could he get this kind of intellectual stimulation. Why don't you just go to school, Mark? Why don't you just complete your high school degree and talk your way into a nice computer science department somewhere? School is not for Mark, he says. They don't teach the kinds of things he wants to know. Mark only cares about specific arcane computer networks, the crazy puzzling over how they're put together and why they work a certain way. Phone company networks. TimeNet system. He can lecture for hours about those systems. Mark's a specialist who isn't interested in the more general knowledge that computer science departments offer about how to program a VAX or a Unix computer. No, Mark is as niche-oriented as a medieval scholar. So why doesn't he get a job with the phone company? Well, there's this misdemeanor conviction for one thing. But for Mark, another bigger reason is that he believes if he went to work for a phone company, his understanding would be limited to the architecture of a single, local system. That's not for Mark. He wants to know how everything works, and he's willing to teach everybody else. which is why he is leading Julio and John through the intricacies of navigating TimeNet to get to Southwestern Bell. They are eager students. Why are John and Julio so interested in this endeavor? Southwestern Bell's C-scans control every switch in Texas. Southwestern Bell controls the phone service of Chris Goggins, of Scott Chasen, and now of the brand new ComSec offices.
12. Kenyon's mom hired some people to fix it up, so the new office was really cool. Very professional. ComSec opened its doors in May of 1991, and the business partners quickly made themselves at home in the area headquarters. ComSec has a huge vaulted ceiling with skylights and faux gas lights in the two corridors. Some days, ComSec's founders skateboard down the long, empty halls of the vast space or roll around in chairs. Chris was living in the back of the building, in an apartment with a big, white-bellied cat named Spud. But there was a problem. ComSec had zero clients. The officers of ComSec hold weekly staff meetings, which they all attend. They decide to distribute press releases advertising the availability of their security services. But to whom? As ex-hackers, they compile a list of likely clients. They scan the files on underground bulletin boards to find the names of businesses whose computers have been infiltrated, then call the companies to offer their services. The press release must have done the job, because in June, less than a month after ComSec officially opened its doors, both Time and Newsweek ran stories about the hackers turned anti-hackers. The very next day, the office phone started to ring. And ring. You couldn't buy advertising better than Time and Newsweek. ComSec had clients. One client, a consultant representing the telecommunications industry, ordered up some research on recent regional Bell Company crashes. The client paid $5,000 up front. Of course, the publicity in Time and Newsweek had another effect. Up north,